This is 1A. I'm Indira Lakshmanan in Washington. China describes them as re-education camps, mass internment facilities in northwest China that the government says are necessary to counter terrorism and religious extremism. Over the last 3 years, the Chinese government has corralled an estimated 1 million Muslim citizens, the largest group of whom are known as Uyghurs, in what Beijing calls a people's war on terror. Xi Jinping's Communist Party says the camps are for education, but two sets of internal Chinese government documents leaked to the media paint a terrifying picture of incarceration, indoctrination, punishment, even death. Families of those relegated to these camps have been kept in the dark about what's happening to their loved ones on the inside, including at least one of our listeners.
My name is Mutalib Ghopper. I live in St. Louis, Missouri. I am a Uyghur, 2 to 3 million Uyghurs in a concentration camp. But all Uyghurs in the Xinjiang region in concentration camp cannot talk to their family member who are in the outside of China. In 3 years, I have not talked to my family yet because they are scared to talk to me. I don't know what's going on, alive or die, I don't know.
That distressing voicemail was left in our inbox by one of our listeners. This hour, we'll be talking about what we have learned from recently leaked Chinese government documents and how the international community should be confronting these atrocities. Joining us on the phone from Hong Kong is Austin Ramsey, a correspondent for The New York Times, which last month published one set of leaked documents that revealed the Chinese government's years-long plans and policies to oppress the Muslim minorities in the Xinjiang region. Austin, welcome to 1A.
Hi, Indira. Thank you.
And here with us in the studio is Saleh Hudayar. He's the newly elected prime minister for the government in exile of East Turkestan, the name that Turkish independence activists use for the Chinese region known as Xinjiang. He's also the founder of the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement, a nonprofit human rights group based here in D.C. Prime Minister Hudayar, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Indira. Thank you for having me.
Also with us here in studio is Louise Grieva. She's the director of global advocacy for the Uyghur Human Rights Project. Louise, welcome.
Thank you so much.
We also reached out to the Chinese embassy here in Washington to participate in this conversation and did not hear back, but that invitation still stands for them to join us. And we apologize in advance for any background noise you may hear during this broadcast. The WAMU building is undergoing construction. So, Prime Minister in Exile Hudayar, I want to begin by asking, before we talk about these newly leaked documents, please give us an overview of the history of this region.
So, East Turkestan, Uyghurs state that, according to Uyghur historian Turgun Almas, that we have a history of over 6,400 years. East Turkestan is the homeland of the Uyghur and other Turkic peoples, such as the Kazakhs, Kyrgyz, Uzbeks, and Tatars. This region was occupied by the Manchu Qing Empire back in 1884 and renamed to Xinjiang, which literally translates as the new territory. With the fall of the Qing Dynasty in 1911, the region was governed by various Chinese warlords who implemented Sinicization policies by settling Han Chinese settlers. This raised Uyghur and other Turkic grievances, and they rebelled and declared the first East Turkestan Republic in November 12, 1933. However, this was overthrown due to Soviet intervention and the Republic of China invading the region. And then again in 1944, Uyghurs rebelled again and declared the second East Turkestan Republic, which lasted until December 22, 1949. Yesterday is the 70th anniversary of China's People's Republic of China's official occupation of East Turkestan. Since then, China has been engaging in what we believe is a campaign of colonization and genocide.
Well, as you point out, there are various ethnic groups that make up the majority of the population in the Xinjiang region. Even though they are considered minorities in the rest of China at large, they're obviously, the biggest groups in that region, with the Uyghur as the largest among them. You yourself are a Uyghur who came to the U.S. with your family as a political refugee in the early 2000s. What was happening in the region when you left?
So in the region when we left, in 1997, we had demonstrations, pro-democracy, pro-independence demonstrations, and the Chinese government severely cracked down on that. In fact, in 1997, the Chinese government claimed that they arrested 100,000 ethnic separatists, splittists, and counter-revolutionaries. My uncle was one of those who had been arrested, and his simple crime was for reading a book. So this led many in our family to fear for their lives, and so my father had fled the country already in 1995. And in 1998, he came to the United States and applied for asylum here, and then brought us to the United States in 2000.
Now, you still have family in the region, though. What, if anything, have you been able to hear from them or about how conditions are for them now? I would think particularly being connected to you as a very prominent exiled activist and promoter of a separate nation, that your family would be targeted.
Yes, I have 86 male relatives that were detained and 15 female relatives that were detained. The last time I was able to directly speak with anyone in the country was July 2017 with my grandfather on my mother's side, and he told me, "Don't call us anymore. I'm too old to go to school," referring to the so-called re-education camps. Since then, I haven't been able to directly contact anyone inside the country. We have a relative in Central Asia, and he told us that they're bothering, that I need to stop my activities because they're bothering our relatives inside East Turkestan. And I told him, no, just tell them that you don't know me because I'm not going to stop. That relative later ended up going to East Turkestan despite me warning him, don't go back because you will be thrown into these camps, and now we don't know anything about him or where he's being held.
And of course, to remind our listeners, when you refer to East Turkestan, it's the same region that the Chinese call the Xinjiang Autonomous Region in northwest China, just so people are clear. The BBC's John Sudworth toured the camps when Chinese officials, quote unquote, opened them up to journalists. Here's some of his reporting.
Over the past few years, a vast network of high security facilities has been built across China's western region of Xinjiang, surrounded by high walls, barbed wire, and watchtowers. But in some of the places we're being taken to, the satellite images show that the internal security fencing and what look like watchtowers were taken down shortly before the tours for journalists began. And empty exercise yards have been transformed into sports facilities. Hey! On full display when we visit. But if these are show camps, what might that say about the places we're not given access to? With their watchtowers and barbed wire still in place, they look much less like schools. And we're much less welcome. All of this, China says, is a response to decades of sporadic separatist violence. But Xinjiang's Muslims, the Uyghurs, the Kazakhs and others are being swept up, it seems, for the mildest of beliefs and behaviors.
Louisa Grieva of the Uyghur Human Rights Project, tell us from your study of this issue, how has China tried to control the narrative around these camps?
The campaign against the Uyghurs and other Turkic Muslims has been conducted under conditions of absolute secrecy. And as we know from the New York Times documents, these were explicit instructions to officials to lie to family members if they found them missing. They were going to be told they've gone to school, it's for their own good. We know of documents showing that the officials and employees responsible for maintaining these camps would be severely punished if they gave out any information. So right until very recently, the information we had was from the very few people who survived and people like Sally's relatives who were able to give fragmentary information.
Well, let me ask you briefly, because one of our listeners, Christiane, emails, I'm concerned about the frequent use of the word concentration camp versus what she believes is more accurate and realistic, the term internment camp. Internment more accurately describes what China is doing as it relates to our own misguided, unjust, and fear-based actions when we in the U.S. interned the Japanese during World War II. Is Christiane right about this, Louisa?
Well, there's another element here, which is that the Chinese government is determined to make the Uyghurs Chinese, to exterminate their entire culture and identity. You can't believe in Islam. In fact, in the camps, you're forced to repeat over and over again, I don't believe in Islam. I made a mistake believing in God. I believe in the Communist Party. So the element of, for want of a better word, brainwashing is extremely severe.
When we come back, we're going to be talking with Austin Ramsey, the New York Times correspondent who wrote about leaked documents from the Chinese government about their work and policies regarding Uyghurs and other Turkic minorities. We'll also be speaking with Saleh Hudiyar of the East Turkestan Government in Exile, and more with Louisa Griva, Director of Global Advocacy for the Uyghur Human Rights Project. I'm Indira Lakshmanan, Executive Editor at the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Hey, Mindy here from NPR's Wow in the World. Join Guy Raz and me for our special 100th episode, a musical! Science, laughs, melodies!
Melodies!
It's Wow in the World from Tinkercast and NPR. Listen now and share with your kids.
This is 1A. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. We're discussing China's treatment of Turkic Muslim ethnic groups in the Xinjiang region of China. Here's what one listener left in our mailbox.
My name is Nathan, calling in from Colorado Springs. My wife and I have about 30 years of experience closely interacting with the Uyghur people. We lived there for a long time, and now we're involved here in the United States with this issue. Just wanted to affirm from our experience that this is a very real human rights crisis, and we would like to see people in the United States and around the world join in and raise their voices, pay a lot more attention to what's going on. This story is huge, and we need to be very involved.
So, Austin Ramsey, the New York Times, under your byline and that of another colleague, recently published a few hundred pages of leaked documents detailing the crackdown on Muslim ethnic groups in the Xinjiang region. Tell us what some of the key takeaways were from your reporting.
One of the key takeaways was exactly who ordered this and how this came about. For a long time, it wasn't really known how high the decision-making went. It was understood that the party secretary in Xinjiang, a man named Chen Chunguo, sort of led the crackdown, but we didn't really understand the level of authorization that he had. And in these documents, there's a series of speeches from 2014 of Xi Jinping, the Communist Party General Secretary, the leader of China. And in those speeches, he, both during a visit to Xinjiang and then also a meeting in Beijing to decide on Xinjiang policy, he calls for very strong efforts to deal with what he sees as the problems of separatism and religious extremism in Xinjiang. And, you know, these are quite extensive speeches, so he says a lot of things. He even says that we shouldn't discriminate against Uyghurs and things like that. But the bulk of what he says at great length is talking for the sort of very firm hand in Xinjiang, and it's something that goes beyond what was the policies in the region before. And then shortly after that, we see a number of small camps, small re-education efforts for holding people for weeks or months begin. And then in 2016, Chen Chunguo comes to Xinjiang from Tibet. And he takes those speeches from Xi and he redistributes them to officials in the region. And in early 2017, the sort of camps begin in earnest. And he points to those Xi speeches and says these camps are fulfilling what President Xi has called for.
So, Austin, can I just ask you, what in your reporting, what type of offense, quote unquote, would cause a person to be sent to one of these camps? Or are people being sent even without any perceived infraction, just sort of in a so-called preventative way?
The infractions that people can be sent to camps for are can be incredibly minor. I've talked to a person who was sent to a camp because she had WhatsApp on her phone, which is seen as suspicious because it's not as easily monitored in China. There are people who are sent to camps for having long beards or praying regularly or various signs of religious devotion. There are people who are sent to camps for having traveled abroad, for having contact with relatives abroad. There are dozens of things that can get you sent to camps. Many, in fact, I would say most of them are things that are perfectly legal for Han citizens of China to do.
Meaning the majority ethnic group in China when you say Han Chinese.
Exactly. But if a member of a Turkic minority group does these things, then it can get them sent to a camp in Xinjiang.
Including children, which makes it hard to understand exactly what so-called offenses or infractions a child would be placed in such a camp for.
Well, there's not much report on children being sent to camps, but what does end up happening is because parents are sent to camps, there are often children who are left behind and without adults to care for them, and then they are sent to these orphanages that are filled with children of parents who are in camps. And so this is in many ways it's a further punishment to families.
I notice your use of the word camps without any adjective, and I'm curious how you would respond to the listener who was debating whether these should be called concentration camps or internment camps or something else.
Yeah, that's a good question, and one that we've gone over many times and discussed how exactly we would describe these. You know, technically speaking, these are concentration camps in the sense that a concentration camp is a place where a group of people is concentrated. But the problem is that the connotation of the word concentration camps brings up sort of World War II era death camps where people are sent to be killed. And to the best of our knowledge, these people aren't sent to camps to be killed. There are people who die in camps, and we know that medical care can be quite poor and conditions can be quite poor, and it probably does have an effect on mortality. But to our knowledge, the goal of these camps is not to kill people. And so we don't use the word concentration camp, at least in our reporting, because we feel it sends a signal that it's something like a Nazi concentration camp. Generally, what we say is indoctrination camps, because we feel that, you know, from our reporting, it shows that the purpose of these camps is to change people's outlook, to make them secular, to make them obedient to the Communist Party. To us, indoctrination camp is probably the word we choose to describe these.
Mm-hmm. Saleh Hudayar, I'm curious about your take on what word should be used. And I want to emphasize that, as Austin Ramsey says, there is one takeaway that came out of last month's reporting on a separate set of cables known as the China cables that were reported on by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the ICIJ, and 17 partner news outlets, including the New York Times. And in that set of leaked documents, one of the aspects was a 9-page operating manual for the detention camps written in November 2017, detailing how to prevent escapes, how to indoctrinate detainees, and how to prevent so-called abnormal deaths. So one takeaway from the reporting on that was that the Chinese government knew it was putting hundreds of thousands of ethnic Muslims, Turkic groups' lives at risk, but they did not intend them to be death camps per se. And yet there are reports from inside Xinjiang of people dying there. So what is your take on those cables and what we should be calling these camps?
So I think it's accurate to describe them as concentration camps. This past May, the U.S. Department of Defense stated that there's at least 1 million and upwards of more likely 3 million people being held in what they described as concentration camps. Yes, there are not there are people that are being politically indoctrinated, but that's not the only thing that's happening. There are reports, you know, former detainees have described being raped, being forcibly medicated, being sterilized, being subject to torture, and forced starvation. In fact, Radio Free Asia this past October reported that in one camp alone, in a period of 6 months, over 150 people had died. So, yes, it's not happening on a mass scale, but people are dying in these camps. And essentially, even if the Chinese government is trying to prevent these deaths, they're not doing enough to exactly prevent these deaths from happening.
Luisa Grieva, how do you stack up these revelations that came out in these two sets of documents that were recently reported on with the Chinese government's insistence that these camps are for voluntary re-education to counter terrorism and religious extremism?
Well, it's pretty simple. The documents themselves talk about preventing escape. You wouldn't escape if you were there voluntarily.
Saleh Hudayar, I want to ask what it is like for those in the Xinjiang region who have not yet been detained and sent to camps. It's really hard to imagine going about so-called normal daily life if your neighbors or your relatives have been sent away, or if you fear that any day it could be you next.
So everyone lives in a constant state of fear. There's checkpoints every 500 meters across most of East Turkestan. Even to buy gas or even to, you know, visit one neighborhood, you'll have to get a special permission from your local little police station, these police boxes that they set up. I remember back in July 2017, my grandmother had told me that despite my aunt living less than 2-3 blocks away, she hadn't seen her in several months.
Wow. One of our listeners, Steve, emailed in saying, I'm an immigration lawyer in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I do asylum cases from China. I've represented many Uyghurs over the last 20 years. What's less known is how immigration authorities under the Trump administration have adopted a policy of erecting procedural stumbling blocks for asylum applicants. It's extraordinarily upsetting to people who don't even know if their family members are alive in re-education camps. Luisa, tell us what you know about that, and also how many Uyghur or Turkic refugees have fled China, and how many of them live here?
Luckily, for the Uyghurs, we don't know of any cases of asylum applications being turned down. Unfortunately, it is a frustratingly long process. Some people have been waiting just for their interview for a number of years, and this adds a terrible layer of stress to their situation. They're safe here, but they don't feel safe. The biggest problem with Uyghur refugees is in Central Asia and Turkey, where there are lots of people who do not have secure status. Residence can be very hard to come by, and we're pushing for more international attention to their plight.
So you're saying that most of the refugees are actually in Central Asia. Are they able to keep contact with their families still in Xinjiang?
It's very dangerous for them to do so, both to the relatives back home. And there are reports of Chinese government officials pressuring officials in neighboring countries, which makes their situation very precarious. And we're calling for international refugee protection organizations to be much more active in helping them in Turkey and Central Asia.
And do you have a number of how many are here in the U.S.?
According to the census, there were between 8 and 10,000 Uyghur speakers here as of 2015.
All right. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Luisa Grieva of the Uyghur Human Rights Project, Saleh Hudayar, founder of the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement, and Austin Ramsey, a New York Times correspondent who's reported on this from his base in Hong Kong. More from our guests and from you in a moment. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
Think of NPR's Life Kit as that friend who always has great advice about everything from how to invest to how to get a great workout. We bring you tools to help you get it together. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit.
I'm Indira Lakshmanan, back now to our conversation on the treatment of Turkic and Muslim ethnic groups in the Xinjiang region of China. One of our listeners, Bruce, emailed, "We are supporting mass atrocities in exchange for cheap electronics. Every dollar, euro, shekel, or other currency that flows into China is hurting millions of people. I'm a realist, and I know this will hurt and hurt hard, but we are at war and it takes sacrifice. I'm ready to defend America and its supposed principles." So the point, Saleh Hudayar, that Bruce is making here is that the United States, not only its government, but its citizens, are making a silent bargain to shut up about abuses in exchange for cheap TVs and cell phones and everything else. What's your response to that?
I mean, this is exactly true. I mean, the American people and the American government, you know, and other governments and people are using, you know, economics, their economic interests before human rights. And this has a massive impact on the people of East Turkestan, Tibet, and the people of China as a whole. And this is how China controls, you know, the narrative of what they're doing to the Uyghurs and other people through censorship.
Well, Louisa, just in September, our Secretary of State Mike Pompeo blasted China's treatment of the Uyghurs at a meeting with foreign ministers of five Central Asian countries. He said, quote, "I want to make clear that China's repressive campaign in Xinjiang is not about terrorism. It's about China's attempt to erase its own citizens' Muslim faith and culture. We call on all countries to resist China's demands to repatriate Uyghurs." So tell us, Louisa, to what extent has the Trump administration actually confronted these atrocities itself beyond asking Central Asian nations to do so?
Well, the U.S. government is the only government so far in the world to impose sanctions. In October, there were 28 entities, both government and private companies in Xinjiang, that were put on the export control list. So no American goods or services can be sold to these bodies, the Xinjiang police. And announced, Secretary Pompeo himself announced visa bans on those the perpetrators of these massive human rights violations. But the best news
with
is,
actual names attached to those?
No names. If there were global Magnitsky sanctions imposed, it would be publicly announced to hold them accountable in the eyes of the world, and there would be freezes of their assets as well as barring them from coming to the United States. And we've been certainly calling for global Magnitsky sanctions to be applied to these perpetrators. The best news is the European Parliament voted last week on a resolution calling for all European states to impose targeted sanctions for these abuses. And that's a huge breakthrough because Europe has been much more silent than the U.S.
From what has been said in Washington, though, to what extent is it words but without actual action behind it if we don't have people to enforce these sanctions upon?
We're certainly calling upon the U.S. government to go further and expect that with the Congress now activated, you know, there have been two overwhelming votes in our Congress to pass bills addressing the human rights crisis in the Uyghur homeland. In the Senate, it was passed unanimously in September, in the House by a vote of 407-1 in December. And the two bills just need to be reconciled, and then they'll become law. And that should set an example for other countries.
This, you're referring to the House of Representatives' passage of the bill to counter, quote, arbitrary detention, torture, and harassment of Uyghurs in China, and it now needs approval from the Senate and from President Trump. Saleh, one of our listeners tweeted, "Why is there silence on the part of Muslim-majority countries to the mass imprisonment of Uyghurs and Turkic groups who are Muslim?"
So, again, this comes back to the issue of economics. China has the One Belt, One Road strategy to achieve global economic domination. And so it's invested billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in these Central Asian countries, Pakistan, even in Turkey, even in countries in the Middle East. So these countries are reluctant to give up this economic benefit that they receive from China. And so they're remaining silent to the oppression.
And so I want to ask then, you know, for a while it was difficult to know what was going on in these internment camps. But now that we have this fresh evidence from actual government cables and government policy manuals, nations and corporations can no longer say we didn't know. So could and should companies and countries exert financial and diplomatic pressure on China on these issues in a more outward way?
Yes, I think first they need to recognize this situation in East Turkestan as a genocide. And I just want to give quickly about what the meaning of genocide or the definition of genocide is in Article 2 of the Convention. So killing members of the groups, causing serious bodily or mental harm, deliberately inflicting conditions calculated to bring its physical destruction in part or whole, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, and forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. All of this is already happening in East Turkestan. You have millions of people being locked up in these concentration camps, and this is creating a psychological impact, not only in the people inside the camps, but also outside the camps, and even to Uyghurs and other Turkic peoples in the diaspora, like myself and many others.
So you're saying that we should be calling this on the record a cultural genocide?
I think we should be calling it not just a cultural genocide, but as a genocide as a whole, because there are people dying in these camps. I mean, they're not in mass numbers, but people are dying. China is preventing births. You know, they're sterilizing the population to prevent, you know, the future of our existence.
The news website Axios broke a story recently that China sought to use a loan from the World Bank to fund facial recognition technology, night vision, and other surveillance in schools in Xinjiang. The bank said that money was never dispersed. Tell me your thoughts on that and in general on the responsibility of international organizations and corporations to potentially rethink their business with China in light of these new findings.
So this past December, I believe it was December 5th, the World Bank put out a statement defending its loans, its $50 million loans to these so-called vocational training colleges, is what the World Bank said. They stated that they sent, you know, people to view these sites, but they were only able to view one site after a period of 1 month, and they're going to, you know, track this project. However, we had a demonstration last Friday, and afterwards, after the demonstration, I was able to meet with some World Bank representatives and raise this issue, along with giving them a letter signed by various Uyghur organizations across the world. They said that they would look into it, and you know, the representative he felt bad from the conversation we had. He felt bad, and he said he would definitely get it up the chain and have them look at it.
One of our listeners, Amra, says, Reba says, as a Muslim American, I applaud your coverage of Uyghur Muslims who are being put in concentration camps in China. We need more media coverage and legislation now. So, Louisa, let me ask you, what would you suggest to people who are listening now and want to help? What can they do?
They should certainly get in touch with their members of Congress to urge swift action. They can also call the White House and ask for sanctions.
Saleh?
Following what Louisa said, I think the first thing that we should do is pressure the Senate senators to pass the Uyghur Act, and then again call on follow-up legislations to recognize the atrocities of genocide.
Saleh Hudayar is the newly elected prime minister for the East Turkestan Government in Exile and founder of the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement. Louise Agriva is director of global advocacy for the Uyghur Human Rights Project. And Austin Ramsey is based in Hong Kong for the New York Times. Thanks to all of you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, D.C., and is distributed by NPR. Till we meet again, I'm Indira Lakshmanan, executive editor at the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Thanks so much for listening. This is 1A.